Coming up on Weekend America.
If you're going to the theater this weekend, how authentic do you want the experience to be?
I love getting to work with not only some really talented actors, but also some really talented actors that know what gunpowder smells like.
This hour, putting the Iraq War on an American stage. I'm Desiree Cooper.
And I'm Bill Radke. Mike Pacheco did the opposite. He took his American dance band to an Iraqi stage.
So we just wanted to give you a couple of hours of celebration to say thank you for all that you do for us and for your country.
We'll talk with him about war, loss, and music. And you might think a jazz group doing David Bowie is kind of funny.
The fact of the matter is we're a progressive jazz group that travels around in a van, and we're not doing that as a joke.
Funny or not, here comes the Bad Plus. They're on stage this weekend, and they're on Weekend America after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, Happy New Year. I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul, Minnesota.
And I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles. We're honoring 2007 by following up on some of our favorite stories this hour. In September, John Moe is desperately trying to preserve his youth by putting a stop to the Van Halen reunion tour. So we'll learn how that turned out later this hour. Meanwhile, what band would you like to resurrect for a tour?
I'd pick NSYNC. Because I was one of those girly girls who absolutely loved NSYNC.
Well, I already heard that Led Zeppelin is going to do a reunion concert, so I'm really looking forward to that one.
Who broke up? I don't know. The Beatles.
It would be fun if the Beatles could come back.
I would get the Beatles back together.
Oh, Spice Girls are getting back together.
The one band or artist that I would bring back if I could would be Klaus Nomi.
Oh, I'd like Lynyrd Skynyrd to get back together.
Maybe Sammy Davis Jr. Just have him come back and sing and swing and do what he did just so wonderfully.
Well, Sammy was with the group, the Rat Pack. We could bring them all back.
Yeah, the Anachronism Pack. Those voices came to us from New York, Seattle, Ann Arbor, Michigan, and Anchorage, Alaska.
This weekend, we're revisiting some of our favorite people of 2007, and we start with Sean Hughes. Now, this weekend, Sean is getting ready for 3 months in Madrid, Morocco, and London. He's going to leave on Thursday. He'll be working on a film about the Iraq War. That's a subject that's very close to his heart because Sean is an Iraq War veteran. When we first met him in March, he had left the Theater of War and formed the Vet Stage Theater Company, casting other war veterans in his plays. And in the spring, when Weekend America's Chrissy Clark visited him, Sean was staging The Wolf. Here's Chrissy's report.
When you pull the trigger on an M16, you cause a chemical reaction. First, a firing pin hits the center of the bullet cartridge, which makes a little spark. The spark ignites the gunpowder inside the cartridge. The gunpowder burns up. A wisp of smoke rises from the muzzle and reaches your nose.
There's napkins right here. Nobody wants a napkin?
But right now, it's the smell of Chinese food that's in the air. It's the first all-cast read-through of The Wolf.
Come on, guys, get civilized. You're looking like actors.
I went 2 months without a bath, you know, or a shower in Iraq. You know, we ate with our fingers over there, so we're all civilized now.
That's Sean Hughes, a single dad from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. He's a former Marine, joined up on September 12th, 2001, and fought on the front lines during the invasion of Iraq. He's also the artistic director of Vet Stage. He wrote The Wolf and will perform the leading role.
I love getting to work with not only some really talented actors, but also some really talented actors that know what gunpowder smells like.
There are lots of ways to divvy up the world, but Sean Hughes keeps coming back to one, the smell of gunpowder. Here he is again.
Veterans are very seldom given their own voice. All too often we have our experience defined for us.
How is it defined for you?
By the media, the politicians that largely couldn't even tell you what gunpowder smells like.
Not all the vets in the play have seen combat, but they've all been exposed to gun smoke and to the military mindset, like Damian Leake. He's a professional actor who got a medical discharge before he was sent to Vietnam. He was in the Army for less than 5 months, but he still remembers his time as a soldier.
There are moments when I'm walking down the street and I'm going left, left. Just, it never leaves you.
A few weeks later, the cast is rehearsing in Hollywood. Sean plays the character Joey Del Riva, a disgraced Iraq vet locked in a military psych ward. The play follows Joey as he grapples with his memories of Iraq and searches for a place in civilian life. In this scene, Joey's approached by his military psychiatrist, played by a civilian actor named Blake Robbins.
I just noticed you were still up.
You gotta smoke.
Like the playwright Sean, the character Joey smokes a lot of cigarettes and keeps his dog tags stuffed down his shirt. Like Sean, Joey struggles with PTSD and tries to make sense of what he saw and did in Iraq.
I mean, I know you really want to help us out, sir, but you're clueless.
Really?
But Sean and the character he plays are not completely alike. Joey faces a possible court-martial for murdering an Iraqi family. He's become aggressive and violent.
You ever been in combat, sir? Ever?
I've spent 15 years on different psychiatric wards, dealing with the fallout from combat, training, all kinds of trauma. In my own...
So no, right?
Take 10 and then let's kick ass.
Diet Coke cans and newspaper articles about the war are scattered around the theater. But the cast doesn't talk about the war much. There's a gun in one of the scenes in the play, and during the break, the director gives some notes to the civilian actors about how to use it safely. Sean leans against the door to the theater and smokes. Besides the smell of gunpowder, he has another way of dividing the world. There are wolves, and there's the flock.
American society would be the flock, and the flock are sheep. We ask a segment of our flock to become warriors, and the warriors are wolves.
In the play, Sean asks, what happens to the wolves when they come back home? Is there a place for them in the flock? But as good as Sean is talking about the metaphors of his play, he avoids talking too much about his own experiences in Iraq. Sean says it's not the intensity of the death and violence that civilians misunderstand. It's the fact that after a while, you stop feeling it.
I saw a little boy that was killed in Nasiriyah that I probably think about quite a bit. I honest to God, didn't care, you know, when I saw it. I mean, it registered, obviously, because I thought about it. A lot. But it was a difficult thing for me to really come to terms with how insensitive, I guess, I felt at the time, and really judging who I was in combat by a civilian standard, maybe.
Maybe that's why Sean is such a good actor. Because the stage might be the only place where he can work out what he saw in Iraq, where he can overcome the numbness with dramatic emotion, literally.
Hold on, what's that? Am I in?
Sean has to get back on set to block out some stage combat for a scene. As he leaves, I remember something he told me the first night I met him at the read-through of the play.
I mean, combat's combat. I mean, it's f***ing real. And with this art, we're telling a story that we hope impacts people so that they go out of that theater and they do something real. But, I mean, combat, nah, nothing compares to it.
When you pull the trigger on an M16, you cause a chemical reaction. The gunpowder burns up. A trail of smoke rises from the muzzle and reaches your nose. But more important than that is the bullet that comes screaming out of the gun barrel faster than the speed of sound, and where that bullet goes. On Theater Row in Hollywood, I'm Chrissy Clark for Weekend America.
Vet Stage just finished a well-received production of Silent Heroes that's about four military wives who've just found out that one of their husbands has died in combat. Sean's now working on a film based upon a book about the Iraq War. It's called Imperial Life in the Emerald City.
This weekend, we are reconnecting with some of the people we have met in 2007. In January, we introduced you to the Groove Alliance, an R&B cover band from New Hampshire. Their lead singer, Mike Pacheco, is an Army major. And after Mike went to Baghdad in May of 2006, his fellow band members joined him there to play several benefit shows, including one for Iraqi workers.
So we just wanted to give you a couple of hours of celebration to say thank you for all that you do for us and for your country.
الكلمة الوحيدة التي تعبر عن كل ما أحتويه من مشاعر وشكرا لكم ولمجيئكم وشكرا لبلدكم الذي احتضننا.
So God bless you all.
شكرا جزيلا.
Now listen, dance to the music for goodness sakes.
Mike Pacheco is back home now with his wife and son. He told me that while in Baghdad, he made some very deep friendships with Iraqis. And now that he's back, he's been frustrated that Americans seem to care more about Iraq, the policy debate, than about the Iraqi people.
It makes me angry, to be honest with you, at times, to think that throughout the last 4 years, somehow we have forgotten the face of Iraq, those millions of Iraqis who are in the middle of this conflict and who are struggling every day to make their lives better. And if the American people could connect to average Iraqis, I think that the average American would change their mind right away and realize that these are people who want freedom, and they're really not unlike you and I.
When you were with us last, Mike, you told us about a young Iraqi man named Hussein. You had done reconstruction work with him, and your band invited him up on stage to sing with you. Will you tell us what happened to Hussein?
Sure. First of all, Hussein was actually one of those workers in our building who just lit up the building every time he walked in. He was Shia. He lived in a predominantly Sunni area. And was forced to leave his neighborhood. But I can tell you that in our building, both the Shia workers and Sunni workers and Christian workers all loved Hussein. This is a guy who really touched everyone's life. And that day that he came and spent time on stage with the band was a day that he said was the best day of his life. He had never experienced anything like that. His family was under a constant threat from extremist factions. And eventually, as is the case with many, many of our friends, on the way home from work, very soon after the band left, he was killed by a sniper's bullet.
Mike, you obviously still feel connected to Iraq. Now you're home. What will you do next?
Well, certainly go back to the band. I was a contractor for Department of Homeland Security, and I certainly in the short term plan to do that again. But there have been offers to go back to Baghdad working for a USAID contract. And I'm thinking very seriously of going back and completing some of that work.
How do you weigh that desire to go back and finish your work against wanting to be with your wife and your new baby?
My wife understands how deeply I feel about this, and that there will always be that knock at the back of my head all the time that says you had the opportunity to go back and help these people and you didn't, you know, either because it was easier to stay home or more comfortable to stay home, when in fact my friends there are not in very much comfort every single day. So I think I have an obligation.
Mike, I'm really glad you're one of the people we met this year. Thanks for coming back and talking with us.
Thank you.
Mike Pacheco is still the front man for Groove Alliance. His band is about to play its first big gig together since he got back home, a private New Year's Eve show at the Foxwoods Casino in Ledyard, Connecticut.
God, it must be strange for them to play like local dance gigs after being in Baghdad playing.
Yeah. Yeah. Mike was comparing his life with his band and his family. His, you know, the band is still, the set list is the same, still Casey and the Sunshine Band, you know, but it's a whole different feeling. He says these band members hadn't even been out of the States before, and now they've all met Iraqi citizens and heard the mortar fire on Haifa Street. And he really feels like they understand him in a way that even his family doesn't. Mm.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week.
Teens in foster care remind us you never outgrow the need for parents. Coming up on Weekend America. We'll be right back.
From American Public Media, Happy New Year. I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles.
And I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul, Minnesota. Recently, I met 18-year-old Chris and his sister, Amanda, 16. They've been foster children for most of their lives, and they were in danger of aging out of the foster care system without ever having had a permanent home. Well, they were recently featured in the American Radio Works documentary called Wanted Parents. It follows them over the course of 2 years as they search for an adoptive family. Well, their prayers were answered this year by Eric and his wife, Shannon. The couple already had 3 kids, but they committed to bring Chris and Amanda sight unseen into their family. By then, Chris had already spent time in residential treatment for violence, and the documentary details what happened one night when the couple tried to discipline Chris.
Chris started throwing things around, breaking things. He broke my stereo in two, in half. He put that hole in the wall right there. All the picture frames that he was in, he took the pictures out of them. And then he tried to pack up his things and waited for the cops to come.
The couple still went forward with their commitment to adopt both Amanda and Chris.
When Eric and I decided to do this, we knew it was going to be a permanent thing, that if we have to travel around in our retirement years to a penitentiary to visit our children, child or whatever, that's what we have to do.
Well, Chris and Amanda are both here now to give us an update on all that's happened this year. Hi, guys. Welcome to Weekend America.
Thank you.
Nice to meet you.
So, Chris, you're out of treatment. What's it like to be home now?
Well, now when I wake up, you know, I have my mom and dad, because it just used to be me and Amanda, and now I have another sister and 2 brothers, and we argue and stuff, but that's what brothers do, and you know, after we have a fight, we laugh about it.
What is it like for you as brother and sister to be back together in one home again?
Actually, it seems to be really hard at first. Talking is just something we're like, well, why, when hitting is so much easier to do? We're like in toddler years learning how to live with one another, and the love is there, and it's a relief that finally we're together again, but at the same time, it's going to be a really long learning experience.
It's especially hard for me because my parents say, you can be a kid now. And, you know, a situation comes up with Amanda, and I want to be right there, you know, deciding her punishment or, you know, what she gets, you know. And it's hard for me because I've done 17... 18 years of this, and this is the only thing I know.
You've done 17 or 18 years of parenting your sister, is that?
Me parenting her, her parenting me. I think it went both ways depending on, you know, what happened that day.
What advice, Amanda, would you give to a teenager who is looking to be adopted?
I'd say that unless you give up your past, that's basically going to be the layout of your future. I was always debating whether or not I wanted to be adopted after a failed adoption and after being abandoned. It felt as if that was not meant for me at all. And then I'm like, well, all these arrows are pointing me towards being miserable. And I kind of feel like I owe it to myself to fight that current that pushes against me.
Chris, what advice would you have for a teenager that's thinking about being adopted?
Not to give up. And for a while for me, I was scared of, you know, having this new family. And for me, now looking back on it, you know, there was nothing to be scared about because my worst day already happened in my life.
What was your worst day?
Probably when my mom left me. That hurt me and caused me a lot of problems. But to not give up and continue to try and, you know, even if you're not thinking about, you know, not wanting to get adopted, at least have that option in the air. Most people that I met that wanted to adopt me sent me letters. We had people do a video in their whole room showing me their house. And so people are more than willing to go in depth about their family and show you what you'll gain, you know, weigh out the options. If you don't think it'll work, then you can always say no.
Well, one of the things about teen adoptions is sort of the mutuality of it, that you both have to agree that you want to be a part of this family. So what advice would you give to a couple that might be thinking about adopting teenagers as opposed to a toddler?
Things are going to happen, something that the parent won't like or not agree with, it'll probably happen. Not in all cases, but it could happen. And when I think about it before in my family, they had their set rules. But now the parents think, well, what do we do now? We have our set rules, you know, for our kids, you know, and we possibly might get another kid. Because it's not just the adoptive kids that need to change their surrounding. It's, you know, the parents, you know, they got another one to take care of and, you know, support. And, you know, and then you got the siblings, you know, that all want the same, you know, love.
So it could be tough for adoptive parents to bring another, a teenage child into the mix and then have to rearrange their family dynamics.
Yeah.
Every day I say to myself, this is something that I don't think I could have dreamed about 6, 7 years ago because I didn't know it existed. It took us a long time to realize that love is unconditional and it doesn't end because we thought, okay, too much love, now we need to back off a little bit. And we realized that it was the exact opposite. And a lot of times we say that and it just breaks our parents' hearts because I see in their eyes that they wish so much that they could have given us that. And I wish so much that they could have given us that. So just being there and loving and reassuring them all the time that I'm not going away.
But it sounds to me like both of you actually have expressed this. You have a hard time believing mm-hmm. that someone loves you.
Yeah. We couldn't even love each other. I mean, we could give each other hugs, but next 5 minutes we'd be beating each other just because our anger overpowered our ability to love, and it definitely showed.
Do you guys have any New Year's resolutions?
Being together and staying together has basically always been our lifelong goal, so I might as well maintain that. What choice do we have?
That's right. You're together forever now.
Oh, joy. I'm thrilled.
Well, you guys have been great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
There is much more to Chris and Amanda's story. They want to share it with you. Just go to our website at weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This program is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, and KPCC Los Angeles.
What if I told you that in a few minutes you are going to fall in love with the theme from Chariots of Fire all over again? Try me. Stay tuned to Weekend America.
From American Public Media, I'm Desiree Cooper with Bill Radke. Well, 2007 didn't ring in so well for Jim Doherty. Last New Year's Eve, after 37 years, he ended his midnight jazz show on WSUI in Iowa City. Called Big Bands Then and Now, he'd interviewed the greats like Count Basie. But at 72, it was over for Jim.
I don't know, it's kind of a... not really anger or disappointment, but just something I knew was going to be coming, and it was here upon me all of a sudden. It almost be the equivalent, I guess, of being led down that corridor for the very last time, you know?
Yeah.
Well, we thought that was it for Jim, but he's still broadcasting. Producer Kyle Gassett has kept in touch with Jim this whole year. Jim and Kyle, welcome.
Thank you.
Hi, Desiree.
Jim, it's been almost exactly a year since you were there in the studios. How does it feel to be back?
Well, it's sort of a mixed emotion. I kind of realize some of the ups and downs of being here, but I'm happy to have my own situation at home where I can call all my own shots and make my own decisions and so forth, you know?
Well, the last that we heard, we thought maybe you were just sort of going to walk off into the sunset with Stardust being your swan song. So when did you get the idea that you weren't going to walk off into the sunset, that you were actually going to keep broadcasting via the internet?
Well, the program director here at WSUI in Iowa City said there's a possibility of doing something on internet radio, and I should look into that. So I wanted to continue playing because I have a vast library of music that goes back to the 20s. On records, and of course, then I have tapes and CDs and some things of that nature, you know, that I definitely want to share with people. My knowledge and what I have in my library, I think, too valuable not to share with somebody, you know.
Kyle, you produced the story about Jim in January, and I know you've kept in touch with him all year long. And he cobbled together his studio at home with shoestrings and bubblegum. What does his studio look like?
He had an old turntable there, which I lovingly referred to as Old Green. You know, mm-hmm. How old was that turntable? It'd been like from
the mid-1960s, easily.
1960s. And so that's where he would every night, you know, go from that to mini disc so he could come into the station. Well, last year when he finished, I thought, I don't know how this is going to work because he wants to go from that turntable to the computer. So I kind of thought, I had my doubts as to what was going to happen. And I worried that every night he was going to be there wanting to do it and, you know, not having a place to go and not having that outlet anymore to go anywhere. Then when I went over and I saw that he'd actually sort of, it was a whole new gym, you know, a whole new studio,
wow.
A whole new mixing board. Everything was over there. He had ushered himself into the new digital age. I was very impressed. I was very excited more as a listener because I knew that he would be coming back.
Can I quote you? You said I was born again, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Not a Christian necessarily, but just born again jazz fan and broadcaster, right? Not a Christian,
so,
I guess.
Jim, what's it been like for you broadcasting now via the internet versus being live on air?
Well, in a way, I kind of know now who's listening because there's an indication, you know, of people coming in, going. My sister, for example, listens at her computer. But I work all day getting the thing ready. At the time we are recording this right now for the show, I would normally be at home producing some of the show for later on in the evening.
Well, also, that's because you're broadcasting at twice the length that you were before. Your show is now 4 hours a day, is it?
Probably 6 to 8 hours to record a four-hour segment. I feel like if I'm recording it, I can do it the way I want it to sound, you know?
Jim, when the new year rings in, what song will you be playing?
Auld Lang Syne. I have the Duke Ellington arrangement of that, and then I'll probably have Duke Ellington at the Blue Note because I used to hear Duke on the air from the Blue Note on those midnights on New Year's Eve that I didn't happen to be doing a live show.
Jim, when I listen to you talk, there's so much energy and joy around jazz. Do you have any plans on retiring?
I guess when they lower the lid on my casket, that'll be my last. I hope there's a connection wherever I'm going, either up above or down below, you know, that I can do it from someplace, you know.
Well, Jim and Kyle, I want to thank you for joining us and Happy New Year.
Oh, thanks so much.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
I have an idea. Why don't you ring in this new year by listening to Jim and his new show? Find out how to tune in. Just go to weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke. We are ringing out the old by playing you some of our favorite pieces from 2007. Let me introduce this next one by saying that in the mid-80s, my buddy Vance hosted a rock radio show at our local community college, Green River. And one time he let me take over the mic and play a request. Wow. That was the only thing the callers wanted to hear, man. Rush's Tom Sawyer. Rush was beyond heavy metal. They would blow your mind with grandiloquence and progressiveness and Neil Peart's drum kit. And Geddy Lee. Ah! I mean, it may seem overwrought now, but prog rock was just dramatic and exciting. And music needs that today. Maybe that's why Tom Sawyer shows up on the latest album by The Bad Plus. The Bad Plus is this acoustic jazz trio from the Midwest that has made its reputation covering pop and rock artists. You don't hear a lot of jazz groups doing Black Sabbath and Blondie and Nirvana. And the group has gotten praise for this, but also criticism in the jazz world for doing pop covers. I asked them why they decided it was a good idea to interpret Rush.
David and I are confirmed Rush fans of it as young kids.
It was a gateway to us to music like jazz and free jazz and fusion or whatever you want to call it.
Sometimes people think we're playing Tom Sawyer to like make fun of it or something like that, or it's this, this like hyper ironic New York sort of hipster thing, which is really not at all what it is.
Let's hear Tom Sawyer, your take, shall we?
Sounds good.
The Bad Plus. Bad Plus, pianist Ethan Iverson, drummer Dave King, and bassist Reed Anderson. Your new CD is called Prog, as in progressive rock.
No, just as in progressive.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, because when I think prog, I think prog rock, and there's Rush and David Bowie in there, but I wondered, was that also directed at the jazz world at all? Like you're saying, this is jazz, this is progressive jazz.
The word prog clearly is a reference to prog rock, but what those bands were doing really was sort of reinventing what that music could be. They were reimagining it. And I think that that's what our whole MO is, really. Like, how can we reimagine this music? How can we look at it from a new perspective, but from our own very personal perspective, really. How can you take songs from the rock and pop world and play them in an acoustic trio like this as improvisers? Those are all the questions that I think we ask ourselves all the time.
So when people say you're controversial, what does it mean to you to be controversial?
You know, every once in a while we read that somebody thinks we're morons.
The fact of the matter is we're a progressive jazz group that travels around in a van, and we're not doing that as a joke. You know, we've had to look at ourselves too and go, man, you know, Chariots of Fire, can we pull this off? You know, it's like, but we mean it, you know, that's the thing. It's just like, yeah, we will pull it off, and we do do this because we care.
Okay, but Chariots of Fire? I mean, that would be when you say that we're not doing this we're not doing this ironically. Mm-hmm. I mean, the choice of Chariots of Fire, there's no intention there to, you're not winking at anybody.
We can see how that can be perceived, but I'm telling you this. This is just from our perspective. That tune has power, and let me tell you, if you hear that song anywhere, and I don't care who you are, you're the hardest of the hardcore loggers from frickin' Oregon, and that song comes on, you start going, I can do it! I can chop this tree down.
You know,
it's triumphant.
Yeah, I mean, the guy who wrote it is a cat named Vangelis, right? And I'll guarantee you, so he's like, okay, I have to score a triumphant theme for this movie about running. Mm-hmm. So he goes, and he's like, then he's like, that's sounding pretty good. All right, wait a minute. No. Right. This is ecstasy, Bill. This is not, I mean, this is an incredible piece. When Vangelis finished writing that, he probably jogged around the house 8 times shouting to the world. And also, he, of course, could retire after he wrote it because it was a huge hit.
Yeah. It wasn't a hit by mistake.
No kidding. So,
and so how do you take that awesomeness and make it your own? How does that go?
You channel the awesomeness, Bill.
Yeah. Should we play them a segment of Chariots of Fire?
Yeah, sure. Let's play a little bit.
We'll play a little bit of Chariots of Fire.
All right. Some channeled awesomeness. You know, I asked you about controversy, and you guys went to the "We're Not Morons," but I actually met both sides of the controversy. That, you know, there's the criticism, but then there's the genuflecting. You know, you are the saviors of jazz.
That's absolutely ludicrous. Jazz doesn't need saving. Okay. We're just a part of the river that's got all this stuff. You know, jazz has been moving around in different directions forever. You know, you can't stop it. So we're just a part of that tradition. We're a part of rethinking improvising in America. You know, there it is.
From the Bad Plus, Ethan Iverson, Reed Anderson, and Dave King. Guys, it's been a real pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Bill.
Can I hear one more anthem of awesomeness? David Bowie's Life on Mars?
Absolutely.
We'd be delighted to play it for you.
The Bad Plus there. You know the tune. Reed Anderson, bass. Ethan Iverson, piano. Dave King on drums. They're playing at the Dakota Jazz Club tonight in Minneapolis. This song, by the way, is, you may have heard it around. It's getting a lot of play because it's the theme song of the British TV series Life on Mars. Big hit on BBC America about a cop who gets in a car wreck that transported him to the 1970s, the decade that rocked big. And you can hear full-length versions of Tom Sawyer and this tune, other Bad Plus covers you just heard. You hung out at our website, right? Bad Plus, riveting video, helpful links, arresting images, all at weekendamerica.org. It's awesome. Well, we're about to set sail into the last days of 2007. You might be spending some time taking stock of your past year on this planet. And as you do that, consider the language you used. What word or phrase embodies 2007 for you? The lexicographers are considering the word of the year as we speak. I've got my money on subprime or exploding ARM. That's good. I say exploding ARM doesn't count as a word. Same for astronaut diaper, by the way. Waterboarding is too old, I think. A few months ago, I would have said surge was the word of the year, as in troops. But I think surge has receded. I'm with you, Des. I'm going with subprime.
All right. We'll see if we're right. Well, the new Oxford American Dictionary already selected its word for the year, and it's locavore. Mm-hmm. That's someone who eats food grown locally.
Yeah, everyone had heard of that but me, but I think it's a good choice.
I don't think
good
anyone's choice. Heard of that word before, I guess we'll hear it going forward. We're just wondering what word represents your own life in 2007, and maybe it's a new word that you learned and you just couldn't stop using, or maybe it's one that your kids taught you. Word up!
Word of the year from 1986.
Well, my bad. Tell us your word of the year and why. Give us a shout out at weekendamerica.org.
If a rock group you grew up with has gotten old, does that mean you've gotten old? Not if John Moe can help it. It's next on Weekend America. From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper, and this weekend, Las Vegas is alive with the sound of Van Halen. They had a show last night at the MGM Grand. They've got another tomorrow, and not everyone is happy about it. Back in September, when the tour started, we heard from Weekend America's John Moe. See, John is a Van Halen fan from way back, but things are different now. Here, listen to this. I live my life like this, no tomorrow. All I've got. That's Van Halen.
Running with the Devil. It's from 1978. It's youth, vitality, virility, possibility, beauty. I live my life like there's no tomorrow, says David Lee Roth. But there is a tomorrow, and we're living in it. Sounds like this.
And we've got close to 25 of your greatest hits, all the favorites that you've been hearing tearing out of the back of a pickup truck at the Burger King drive-thru for how many summer times?
That's Roth at the press conference announcing the reunion tour. Roth and Eddie Van Halen are both 52 years old. Alex Van Halen is 54. And weirdly, 16-year-old Wolfgang Van Halen is in the lineup. Also in the lineup, a looming, ominous harbinger of mortality. As we age, or as those of us raised on the band age, memories of young Van Halen fortify us against decay and fear of death. They are forever young. We listened to them when we were young, ergo, we are still young. I need that. When they're old and have a leathery reptilian look, I don't need that. This tour is just a gateway to Sucktown, and I aim to stop it. I decided to go legit and called my congressman, Representative Jim McDermott, State of Washington, 7th District. Congressman McDermott, you are in Washington. What are you doing to stop the Van Halen tour?
Well,
Congress.
I think there's a timeless quality to this kind of music. I don't think the Congress is going to get themselves to being able to stop the clock.
How about one of those sort of non-binding, expressing a vague sense of negative emotion resolutions that you guys are famous for?
Now there, that we might be able to do.
Yeah.
We're pretty good at doing nothing and making it seem like it's important.
In order to stop this Geritol and Sansevieria Slacks version of Van Halen, I had to go over his head. I went to Seattle's Queen Anne Lutheran Church and talked to Pastor Wayne Backus about bringing out the big guns. Exactly what kind of prayer could I do to get this concert stopped by God?
I think you have to use, you know, probably your best curse. What's the worst possible thing that could happen to them while they're up there?
Some sort of sudden, rapid hernia?
And there's nothing like good psalms to help you get into that one. This is from Psalm 109. May another seize his goods. May his children be fatherless, and his wife a widow. Better, may his children wander about and beg. May they be driven out of the ruins they inhabited. May the creditor seize all that he has. May strangers plunder the fruits of his toil.
You know, a lot of that happened during the Sammy Hagar era. How many of those do I need to do? Just one big one, or do I need to do it constantly?
I think one big one would probably be good. However, it's probably going to take you a lot longer to do one big one than it would to do one short one like, please help him hit those notes.
If I pray for Van Halen to succeed, that's going to be easier?
I think it might be easier, and it'll just be a whole lot more enjoyable experience for you as well.
Good point. If they do sound great, if rock can defy age, that would be fantastic. I'd still be young. But I still think it would be better if armed government goons shut down the tour and never let Van Halen go out in public again. Because I love Van Halen. In Seattle, I'm John Moe for Weekend America.
John Moe is with us again. So, John, how has the Van Halen reunion tour actually gone?
Overwhelmingly successful, Bill. Yeah. Tremendously positive reviews, full arenas. Everybody seems to think the band is stronger and better than ever. They rock just as hard. It's a raging success, which obviously has me deeply concerned and troubled.
How's that?
Well, it's like a zombie movie, Bill. You know, the dead have risen from their graves and are feasting on the brains of the living. We need old bands to stay extinct. Otherwise, new bands and new culture cannot rise up and prosper. Mm. And so with this revitalized Van Halen, the natural order of things is disrupted. The Dave Clark Five may as well go back on tour. Gunsmoke should be put back on the air. The rules of culture no longer apply, and therefore culture is bound to collapse. And when culture collapses, Bill, I don't have to tell you that civilization is next. So a restored Van Halen, yes, a threat to global civilization.
John, do you think you might be overreacting?
No.
Not a chance.
No.
Okay.
No.
Well, so what are you going to do about it? You've tried Congress, God, what's next?
I've tried a lot of avenues. The only arrow left in my quiver, Bill, is I have this plan to assemble a sort of anti-Van Halen band. I want to get together Sammy Hagar, Gary Cherone, who was very briefly the lead singer of Van Halen, and deposed bass player Michael Anthony.
John, as I count it, that's two lead singers and a bass player. I think you have a terrible group, don't you?
It's going to be absolutely terrible, but I'm hoping it's terrible enough to counteract the new Van Halen, and they will implode upon themselves, and order will be restored.
Week in America's John Moe. Thanks, John.
Thanks, Bill.
Welcome to Panama. That's it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. Our show is produced with Ben Adair, who I believe is hot for teacher, Julia Barton, Neely Allel, Millie Jefferson, Sam Keenan, Michael Raphael, Susie Lechtenberg, and Tim Bamba.
Also, Johnny Vince Evans, Chrissy Clark, Brendan Newnham, Phyllis Owens, Angela Kim, John Moe, and Mark Sanchez.
Our theme music was created by Galactic. Our executive producer is Peter Clowney. Jim Russell created the show and did not envision Panama probably played for this long. A free podcast at today's show is only one of the treasures you'll find at the following address, weekendamerica.org. And we hope you'll visit us there. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. Hey, get out there and take on the new year.
This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
This is Bill Radke, host of Weekend America. The weekends are for courage.
Yeah, when you come in here, you see a whole bunch of people in there. Hey, they go Pookie. They go Mikey. You know, I didn't expect to see him here. They make you kind of feel like, okay, well, if they're going to do it, then I can do it.
Conquering errands, braving to-do lists, listening to the most memorable stories and ideas every Saturday. Weekend America. Join us.